Okay, welcome everybody back to our tour through Megillus Rus. And I think we got last time to Pasuk Dalad, verse 4 in chapter 3. And we're now at a very key moment. I at least want, if I can, to get to verses 8 or 9. 9 is really important, and possibly even 10, if we can tonight. And let's just see if we can't remember what we discussed last time. Naomi has given Rus a plan. She's told her essentially of her destiny and given her the shocking news that she is very likely to be the good dove from Moab, and that Mahlon's soul is residing in her and needs a way out into the world which can be functioned by the extra legal yibum which is open to her in this particular opportunity. And Naomi has now already given Rus advice as to how she should get this done. In chapter 3, verse 3, we said, wash yourself of your idolatry, anoint yourself with good deeds, and don your clothes. And we said your clothes are what you're garbed in Olam Haba. Those are your special garments in Olam Haba. And this is what you've got to go do. You've got to go down to the threshing floor when he's finished eating and drinking. And you've got to make yourself known to him and say, I am Rus, and I want you to redeem me, as is the mitzvah that is coming towards your hand. You've got to do this. You have to. And then she said at point 4, which is where we're starting today, verse 4, and when he lies down, note the place where he lies and go, uncover his feet and lie down, he will then tell you what to do. Notice, Naomi's plan was that Boaz should never be sleeping. You want to encounter Boaz directly, but you don't want to gain the attention of anyone else when you go there, because they'll see you as probably an immoral woman. That's not okay. What you have to do is just make yourself known to Boaz and say this concept to him, that you're my redeemer, you have to do the mitzvah of Yibam with me. If that works out, he'll do Yibam. Everything will go back via Elimelech through Boaz. Mahlon will be reincarnated, and you'll fulfill your destiny. That's the plan so far. So, what's going on? What is happening? Let's get now into verse 4. So, Naomi was aware. She was aware that there existed a man who was a closer relative than Boaz to do the mitzvah of Yibam. His name was Tov. And he was called Ploni Almoni, which literally means Joe Blogs in the actual text, which we'll get to. And it says that really by rights, he should have first rights to marry Rus in this Yibum relationship. However, Naomi was saying it's quite probable that he will not accept you immediately. Boaz will not accept you straight away and say yes. You'll be the Yavama and I'll marry you, don't worry, because legally there's going to be a problem in the way here. So do what he tells you to do. It's not going to be straightforward. There are other people in this beyond Boaz who he's going to have to legally deal with. But don't be too concerned about that. He's not going to doubt that you're the destined one from Earth. Once he sees you get there, and we'll discuss why, once he realizes you're the one doing this, it'll be so reminiscent of Lot and his daughters that you'll be pointing out by your actions that you are going to be the good dove of Moab. In which case, he'll want to redeem you. Problem is, he won't be able to. That's what Naomi's telling Rus. That's why she said, you should lay down. She says, I will lie down. She used a very unusual lotion. Naomi was hinting that the spirit of her son inside Ruth would be as if she herself was lying next to Boaz, but she was talking to the spirit of her son. But since there's another redeeming relative who takes priority over Boaz, that person will first be offered the chance to redeem and perpetuate the name of my son. So that's very important. Now, Naomi has warned Ruth about two things. There's two separate things that she's warned Ruth about, and we need to get clarity on that. Firstly, she cautioned Ruth to note the place where Boaz went to lie down before he actually went to sleep there. He's going to have like some kind of nesting bedding or something there. Spot that out in your mind. That's target area. Because it's going to get dark, and I don't want you to get mixed up and lie down next to someone else. And if that were to occur, that would be curtains, because they'd for sure take you as an immoral woman, and this whole thing will fall to bits, and there's no way Boaz is going to be interested in you after that. So you can't go to anyone else's bed except for his. She also told Ruth that it will be when he lies down that you should take note. That means you must ascertain absolutely where he's lying down, not from afar, because you might make a mistake in the dark and like search about looking for the right person. That can't happen. You must be able to go like a laser to your target, and your only target is Boaz. So you could really reread this verse as, and when he is lying down, you will have already ascertained the place where he is lying. That's what Naomi is saying to, according to the Medrash. Secondly, that's the first thing. So the first thing is, you can't make a mistake here. It's going to be pitch black in a barn. You have to get the right spot. That's number one. Number two, Ruth is being warned about how to behave when she actually lies next to Boaz. She was not to lie by his side, but at his feet. If she'd have lied at his side, that would have implied that she was at an equal footing with Boaz. Not at all. She was a mere stranger who only recently has converted to Judaism, and he is probably the greatest man in all Israel, which basically makes him the greatest human being on earth. It is not for you to approach such a kingly man in a one-on-one layer. You are going to be at his feet, if anywhere. Okay, you are posh. We also learn out the whole thing to the gerim and the feet. There's a whole thing to do with that. I'll be Kabbalah. It's right for you to be at the feet of such a man. Now, Naomi instructed her explicitly to reveal his feet and lie next to them. That means take up the garment that's around his feet. That means in those days, men wore garments all the way down to their feet, much like the Arabs today wear garments all the way to the feet. Your job is to ruffle up that garment up to his ankles and lie at his feet. That's your job. Now, why? Why? Why am I telling to be at his feet? Being at the feet signifies her poverty and despair, indicating that Boaz, should have pity upon Ruth. If he wished to redeem her, he would show his interest by allowing her to come closer than merely remaining at his feet. He will tell you what you must do, says Naomi. You can only go thus far. Ruth might not wish, this is a very important thing, she might not wish to do this. What she means to say is, he will do the best thing for you. Whatever it is that happens from that point on, he knows he's the greatest judge in Israel. He'll judge the situation correctly. Listen to his instructions from there on in. Now, there's also the possibility that he will think it despicable for any girl to come to lie at his side, and he might take you to be a harlot. So it'd be far better for you to lie at his feet than take any chances here. So those words, go, uncover his feet, were chosen very carefully. Firstly, don't undress yourself. You're staying fully clothed. That will indicate that you're very modest and you're not seeking anything which could be misconstrued here. You go and reveal his feet immediately without undressing anything yourself. Secondly, you should uncover his feet and not cover them back up again. Leave them exposed. you should suggest in a modest way with sneers that he spread his cloak over you, covering both of you together. Thus, when Boaz told, when Ruth, told Boaz to spread his cloak over her, she was saying the instructions that Naomi's given, saying, this is a symbol that you're my redeemer. I want you to spread your raiment over me like a husband at a chuppah spreads a raiment over a kala. Sephardim today still get married where the husband spreads his talus over the kala. That's still a custom which happens today. So they both stand under his talus over their heads, i.e. that's a symbol that she is now coming underneath his remit. That's how it used to be done. In fact, in old pictures of Jewish weddings, you often see the chasen and kala actually standing with the talus over their heads. That's the chasen's talus. Hence the concept, you know, that a kala buys a chasen a talus, it becomes her talus, then he will drape that talus over her at the chuppah, right? So she's saying, do the same thing to me, i.e. marry me and bring me into your home so that yibum can be done. Verse 5. We're at verse 5. And she said, Ruth said back, all that you've said to me, I'll do. Wow. What on earth is going on there? What would she expect? Like, no, I'm not going to listen to you. The meaning is, you have told me that after I lie down near his feet, he will tell me what I must do. Now, this implies that I should abide by his word, even if you wouldn't agree with it. You know, you'll tell me to do A, he told me to do B, and I should listen to him. You're telling me do B, listen to him. No, I'm only going to do what you would tell me. Whatever you give me instruction to do, I'll do. What you don't tell me to do, I'm not going to do. I'm following your word, as it were, not his. Rest assured, says Rus, rest assured that in any situation, I'll only follow your advice. You tell me what to do. And this applies in all cases. Whether he rejects me, whether he allows me to remain, I will only do what you're telling me to do. Whatever you tell me to do, I'll do. What he tells me to do, I might not abide by if it conflicts with your advice. Really a very dedicated Talmidah. She's really, you know, this is her Rebbe, Naomi's her Rebbe, and she's doing what she's being told no matter what. Now, verse 8 is incredibly verbose. Verse 6 is she went down to the threshing floor and did all that her mother-in-law bade her. You don't need to just say she, scrub the words, went down to the threshing floor and did all that her mother, just say she did all her mother-in-law told her to do. You never say she went down to the threshing floor and did all that her mother-in-law told her to do. If she's done all her mother-in-law told her to do, she's got to go down to the threshing floor because her mother-in-law told her to go to the threshing floor. And why did it, you know, miss the whole point about uncovering his feet? Just say she did what she was told. No, she went down to the threshing floor and she did all. Clearly, Shmuel and Avi is telling us something here. Now, it was Naomi who had told Rus to go to the threshing floor. So these words are ridiculous. We don't need them. So Rashi explains that Naomi instructed her to go to the threshing floor only after she had immersed herself in a mikveh. Because she said, wash, anoint yourself. Part of that tshuva process is mikveh. We learn out that if an individual wants to megaya, they have to go to mikveh. If they want to do tshuva, it's right they should also go to mikveh. They don't have to, but especially if they're involved in avodah zarah in any way, a baal tshuva should also go to mikveh. Now, you want to say, well, she's already given up her idols. We said last time that the stain of avodah zarah is so thick and deep that even following conversion, it needs additional work. So she had to go to mikveh before she could approach Boaz. Now, that's what Naomi told her to do. Rus, however, actually thought otherwise. She figured that if she were to go there completely clean and dressed up, she would look more attractive and there would be a greater chance of her becoming a target of assault, which we know was a tremendous risk in those days. Or people would think that she was an immoral woman looking for an opportunity to seduce someone. What did she do? She went first and only afterwards made herself up. This is one reason she did not heed Naomi's instructions exactly. And that's why it says she went down to the threshing floor and did all that her mother-in-law told her to do. But she didn't do all that she told her to do when it told her about going and washing in the order that she was meant to do it in. Very interesting point. Now, Ruth had a series of very scary concerns that were facing her at this cataclysmic moment in her life. She was genuinely worried, and she felt as if she needed Naomi's merit, which is why it says when she went down there, Viradati, there's an extra yud in the verse, in verse 3, when she went down, she felt as if she needed the spirit of Naomi to be accompanying her to do this. Why? Well, obviously we know she's scared to do it, it's a scary thing to do anyway, but she was particularly concerned that several things were going to go wrong. Let's talk about why Ruth was so concerned to do exactly as Naomi had told her and was constantly asking for Naomi's brocha in this. There's quite a few issues. I don't wonder how many I can get through. You see, once she had arrived at Boaz's feet, Boaz himself would surely protect her from any assailant. What she was worried about chiefly was arriving there safely at all. Her vast concern about getting there was about getting there safe. She wasn't so much worried about Boaz as she was about people molesting her on the way and her not getting to Boaz at all, which is why she was so careful to wash herself afterwards, how she was so careful to dress herself down, how she was so careful to stealthily go in there without anyone seeing her. Essentially, her main worry was about getting to Boaz. That was a massive worry, not getting attacked on the way, and it's all over. And once she's been defiled like this, what's going to happen with the spirit of Mahlon? She might not be available for Yibam, Boaz wouldn't want her. The whole thing goes to pot. She was terribly afraid that she would be attacked before reaching the granary. There were so many villains wandering about that she could have been assaulted by any number of people and no one would have come to her aid. Our sages actually say in Rus Rabbah 5:15, that's the Medrash, the people of the time were so immoral that Boaz had to sleep near the grain to ensure that his workers would not steal from it to pay women for their services. So Naomi had to assure us through a brocha that no merit would come to her en route to the granary's threshing floor. You'll even arrive there safe, needs a brocha. You're a lone woman travelling at night in the most immoral time. You're lucky if you even make it to Boaz. She was very concerned about that. Now we're told that she made her way down to the threshing floor like Yaakov, who in Bereshit 28:20 declared, "If God will be with me and guard me on my way," she too silently prayed, "If God will protect me on the way down to the threshing floor, then I'll know that God will help me succeed in my mission at all and fulfill my mother-in-law's destruction." How's this thing going to work? A sign from God will be if she makes it to the threshing floor. You've got to understand how dangerous this place is. You know, let me tell you what it's like. It's like crossing a motorway as a pedestrian at night. Imagine you're on the hard shoulder of a motorway and you need to cross a 6-lane motorway to get to the other hard shoulder to use one of those SOS phone calls. Merely crossing the motorway at night in a place where there's no street lamps, like the M60 has a bit of that at some places and some other motorway, you're lucky you're going to make it. You're probably not going to make it to the phone booth. Once you make it to the phone booth, you're going to be okay. That's how Ruth felt. If I even make it to Boaz's feet, that's already a sign Hashem's with me. That's how dangerous the journey is from where she's staying to get to it's a significant walk in the middle of the night with all kinds of villains everywhere. Now the verse makes quite a bit of sense. she went down to the threshing floor. When she saw that she'd even arrived safely, as Naomi told her, she realized it was Naomi's merit that had accompanied her and got her there unharmed. She actually felt as if Naomi was with her. She was doing everything Naomi was telling her, even though Naomi wasn't with her. She felt as if she was literally holding Naomi's hand all the way to the threshing floor. Okay. Verse 7. There's so much to say on verse 7. Boaz ate and drank, and his heart was joyful. Why do I need to know any of that? That all of that can be deleted out the story, and I wouldn't miss anything. Then, just start the verse from here. Then he came to lie at the edge of the pile. She, Rus, came in stealth, revealed his feet, and lay down. And it was at midnight that the man became startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. Okay, we got, this is it. This is it. This is why you've signed up to this course. Welcome to the third term, by the way. This is the third term here. This is it. This is why you're here. You're here for these psukim, 7 and 8. Although there's lots of interesting stuff later you should know, so don't check out early. The Medrash Rabbah has a lot to say here. Let's first of all talk about the beginning. V'yachol Boaz v'yesht v'yitov. Boaz ate. Notice he ate first. Then the name Boaz is there. Then the word he drank. So if you directly translate this, it says, and he ate, Boaz, and drunk, and his heart was happy. Can you see this? If you have a look at the Hebrew, v'yachol, that's the first word, he ate, and he ate. Boaz, strange. Then his name, v'yesht, and he had drunk, v'yitov liboy. It's a very strange way to construct this sentence. The Medrash says as follows. There were four separate reasons why his heart was joyful. Number one, because he had benched nicely over his food. He'd said nice birchas hamazon. And if you say birchas hamazon really nicely, it should make you happy. And if you don't feel happy when you say birchas hamazon, you're not doing it right. You need to say birchas hamazon with more kavanah. If you say birchas hamazon properly, after you've eaten bread, you will feel happy. Say it in English. Slowly and fervently. You'll go, wow. Hashem's giving me all the food, and he's giving me a beautiful land with an inheritance, and he's sustaining me, and he's looking after me, and he's going to rebuild Jerusalem, he's going to rebuild the temple, and he's going to give me umpteen blessings and the harachamans. You feel great. Amazing, hey? A good benching makes you happy. Reason number two. He ate a sweet dessert, which stimulated his tongue in preparation for Torah study. It's apparently, he wanted to learn after he had eaten, before he went to bed. Balpeh, to say over Torah, if you eat sweet foods, it prepares the voice nicely to sing out for what you're about to do. You're going to go, oh, shikoin gadol, whatever you're going to do. You're going to say the Mishnah. It's nice to have some sweet food. And that sweet food gets the palate in a nice position to sing out words of Torah, because he wanted to sit and learn. So he'd eaten a delicacy, and he wanted to sit and learn, and that delicacy with a desire to learn made him happy. Why are we learning all this? Number three, he had been actively discussing Torah. He'd been involved in Limud Torah over the meal. And it says in Psalms 119:72, the Torah of your mouth is pleasant for me. Hashem likes it when you learn Torah, and it's an enjoyable thing to speak in Torah. So he was happy after having a good Torah discussion. You know, if you've been involved in Limud Torah, it gives you a certain feeling of, say, it's nice. It's nice to be involved in Divrei Torah, and he was happy. His heart was gladdened because of the Divrei Torah he had spoken. Lastly, He was pleased because he was seeking a wife for himself. And it was written in Proverbs 18:22, Motza Isha Motza Toiv, he who finds a wife finds a good thing. And he was happy about the fact that it's time for him to get remarried. What's going on? What's going on? What? He benched nicely? He'd eaten dessert to learn? Or he had been learning or he's looking for a wife? And that's why it says, the Yitav Liboy, his heart was glad, his heart was happy. What has any of this got to do with the price of fish? I mean, who cares? Just in fact, don't tell me any of this. Just tell me he was asleep. He went to bed. That's all I care about. And then Rus comes in, you know. What's going on? First of all, the Medrash had to tell us that he'd said grace over food. Who cares? What's going on? It's like this. A righteous person has a completely different approach to food and drink than a regular person. Especially someone wicked. Righteous person eats in order to sustain his body, in order to serve God. The Chazan Ish says, when I feed my body, it's like I'm feeding my horse. Which is like saying, when I feed my body, it's like I'm going to the petrol station. I've got to put food in the car, otherwise I can't go anywhere. You're eating for your spiritual needs. The wicked only eat because the food's nice and they want to experience pleasure in the eating of the food. He indulges in delicacies and rich wines until he gets carried away, while the righteous eat properly. Now this indicates that Boaz felt happy as a result of the eating and the drinking and the benching. That's not what we would expect from a righteous person. It's not proper for him to just stuff food in his mouth and enjoy the feeling. What was going on, it was a mitzvah to eat and drink, such as Shabbos or Yontif, and it wasn't that at that particular time. The Medrash explains that he felt good after he said benching. So if you have a look, the Targum makes it more explicit. He says, Boaz ate and drank and his heart was happy, because he added a special prayer thanking God for heeding his supplications to end the famine in the land of Israel. Now, we said he was called Boaz as a nickname. Too strong. Strong double. Base to eyes strong or grandeur. His merit ended the famine in the land of Eretz Israel. So when he said Noide Lecha, which is the bit of benching which talks all about the land, he felt as if Hashem was doing him a personal favour. In his righteousness, food is coming back. This is the first proper harvest they've had since the famine, which is why Naomi and Ruth came back from Moab to start with anyway. So he knew, that's my schus. I did that. This night of the harvest is my merit. So after he ate the food that had been threshed in his merit, he felt as if, you know what? I'm a happy man. Hashem has benched me. Not only am I eating, all Klal Yisrael are eating in my merit. See, he was particularly happy that night that the festivities of the thing is over. He's eating a regular meal. That's his meal. Everyone's eating a regular meal because of him. So he thanked Hashem, a special edition in benching, for giving him the merit to be able to be part of the reason that the famine ended and that all people could now eat. That's what the Targum says. So that means to tell us that on that day, the very first stack of grain was piled up after the famine had ended, thanks to Boaz's tefillahs. Consequently, he felt a personal need to thank God for his kindness, both to him and to Klal Yisrael. So he was feeling particularly happy and chuffed with the situation. Does that make sense? That's what I mean, his heart was happy. His heart was happy that he was involved in the finishing of the famine. That's very interesting. After Boaz had finished eating and said, Berachas Hamazon, it was thanks to Boaz, who had prayed on behalf of the people of Israel, that God turned his attention to his people and ended the famine. That's why Naomi even said earlier in chapter 1, God has remembered his people. i.e. Boaz, and he's giving food back. Let's go back. So Boaz was happy. He was able to say Birchas Hamazon at all because for so long there was no food. He was happy to be able to, wow, we can eat. It was a joy to say Birchas Hamazon when you're coming out of a famine. Do you understand? If you've got no food, you're only too happy to be able to eat food and say grace. All right. Now, the Medrash has another thing that it's talking about that we said. It was that he was seeking a wife. Now, if you remember, all the way back in chapter 1, verse 1, we started talking about Elimelech and their children and the Naomi afterwards. Why did Elimelech and Naomi come separately to Moab? Why didn't they travel together? Oh, it's an open question. Now, if you remember, we talked about the fact that righteous people separate from their wives during a time of famine or global distress. And therefore, Elimelech and Naomi had separated and they travelled separately to Moab because it would not be right for them to be together while there's a famine. Right? That's important. Now, Boaz had also separated from his wife in the fact that she'd died. And he had no intention of getting married while there was a famine, because you can't get married while there's a famine, because you wouldn't be able to fulfill the concept of a kasuba if there's a famine. Now that the famine is over with the first grain pile that he's going to lie on in his merit, you know what? That also means the door's open to getting remarried. Now that there's food, he can get remarried. See, he's on his mind now. Now that it's permitted for me to be with a wife, let's think about getting married again, which again made him happy. He felt that it's a good thing. You know what? Not only is Israel in a good place and I'm in a good place and the food's in a good place, it's time to get remarried, which also makes him in a good place. In fact, it's a Gemara in Tanis, Yud Aleph Omad Aleph 11a, that says, during years of dearth, a man must not be with his wife. Now that the famine was over, his heart was joyful because he could look for a new wife because he was widowed. However, he was so convinced that he would find one soon, he even allotted himself the luxury of lying down to sleep and not quickly say, you know what, I ought to go speak to a shadchan right now and do some hishtadlus on my mitzvah of getting married. It's like, I'm sure God's going to organize it. So much so, he went to bed. He was so happy that God was going to find him a wife. He just said, you know what? I don't even need to do much hishtadlus. I'm so happy with the situation. I'm sure God will take care of it. Very interesting ideas. It's an interesting, in Psalms 145:19, we learn that God fulfills the wishes of those that fear him. So it was no wonder that Boaz didn't have to look too far. Ruth was on her way. She was literally winging her way to his feet that very night. Because he was like, you know what? I'm sure God is, I don't need to go to Shah. I don't need to even speak to anyone now. I've got the idea I want to get married. I don't have to, it'll be fine. I'm sure God will organize it. Now, Rus had intended to reach Boaz's resting place while he was very much awake and speak to him normally and bow down. The idea was he'd be either on his bed or sitting, and she would literally prostrate herself at his feet, uncover his feet, and grasp his ankles, begging for mercy. Like a criminal, approaches a king. Do you know what I'm saying? That was the plan. Problem. He'd fallen asleep. Now, Naomi never told him what to do. She doesn't know what to do in this case. She's asleep. Should she turn round? Should she run back? What's she going to do? This is not in the plan. She'd got there at the time where he had just got down. Almost as soon as he got to bed, boom, he fell asleep immediately. Immediately fell asleep, right? So he was asleep instantaneously, which was not meant to happen. She didn't leave it that long for him to go to sleep. He was going to sit and learn Torah anyway. So he'd gone from the meal, go sit and learn Torah. She would approach him, kneel at his feet, say, Boaz, you're my redeemer, redeem me. He'd say, leave it with me, organise things at Bay Stin, she'd go back to Naomi, it's a damn deal. Problem is, she arrives there, he's slipping away. This is a problem. What does Rus do now? What's she going to do? She might scare him by waking him up. How's she going to wake him up? What's going to happen? Should she wait until he wakes up? What's she going to do? Things did not go according to plan. Now, you might think that he fell asleep so quickly because he had drunk so much wine. That's not the case. It says he ate Boaz and he drank. Why is it spelled out? He ate Boaz and he drank. To tell you, he ate a normal meal and he only drank a little bit in order to help digestion. He didn't drink to get shikha. He drank just that. He was not drunk. It wasn't as if he was drunk. And why? Because that means when Rus would approach him, maybe he wouldn't have compass mentis to say, I'll be your redeemer. If he's, by the way, bing, I'm going off. Bing, come with me. When Yaakov was cooking up lentil stew for Avraham Avinu's Shiva, Esav walked in and Yaakov had planned to ask him for the birthright. So much so, he had already written the contract prior, all perfectly worded legally, and he pulled it out while Esav was like, give me some of that food. Now he said, you can have the food, but you've got to sign. Now, Esav was known to be a shikara. He was known by everyone. He, mamish, got paralytic. Let him near alcohol and he gets smashed. Everyone would say, when Esav sat down to eat, he always drank. He must have been drunk. And therefore, if he signs a contract, it's null and void. Because a drunkard signed it. So what was he careful to do? Not allow any booze. Booze and Esav doesn't mix. So he made sure there wasn't any booze. He made soup. That was the drink. He says, you can drink that because I need you to sign this fully compass mentis. Coming back, bing, hit the bell, come back. What's going on? Boaz had to be not drunk for this encounter. He had to be fully compass mentis, understand the legal ramification of what Rus was saying to him, and be completely with it. Nobody could say, ach, you were drunk and this woman approached you and you don't know what you're doing and it's not you anyway. That's a big problem. We can't have that. Now, this is very... Now, why was it that he fell asleep? God caused him to fall asleep and he slept on until midnight, for that was the time that he wouldn't become angry at being awakened. It says it was around midnight. Notice we've got that elsewhere in the Torah where it says that the plague of the death of the firstborn was around midnight. It was kuchatsai, so it was around about midnight. When evil, it's like this, evil builds up in the evening from sunset until midnight. And then it wanes from midnight until daybreak. That's how the forces of evil build up. So they build up from Shkia to Chatzasa Laila till midnight. Then they start losing their potency from midnight all the way to the crack of dawn. And then they're gone. And we daven Shacharis. Does that make sense? Everyone comfortable with that? Now, that means midnight is a crossover between the higher potency force of evil and lower potency force of evil. It's going to be just after midnight that Rus is going to approach Boaz, which means she's not one of the forces of impurity. Let's analyze this. This is a Medrash Rabbah 6:1 on this verse, okay? It says that Boaz was seized by great fear when there was a woman, someone had grabbed his ankle. Someone had grabbed his ankle in the middle of the night, grabbed his, and woke him up. What's going on? He's an old man and someone's attacking him. Think about it. Think about you sleeping and someone who you don't, you're sleeping alone and someone starts shaking your ankle. I think that's enough to give you the heebie-jeebies. Okay, that's pretty scary. Now, it is surprising that he was able to stifle a scream which would have no doubt be heard by all of those in the granary, but we're informed that it was past midnight, just after the stroke of midnight, and in several places our sages have told us that after midnight, the impure forces do not have the power to cause physical harm. So as we pointed out, right, he's gone to bed and God has seen that he's going to fall asleep until after midnight. So when he wakes up, he senses that whatever's happening is not malevolent. This is important. That's what it means. It was at midnight that Boaz was startled. However, he controlled himself and saw that it was only a woman and not some negative shade or a demon or something coming to accost him. That's why it says in the verse, and it was at midnight that the man became startled and turned over. And behold, a woman, not a demon or a gangster, was laying at his feet. He was shocked to see anyone there. He didn't know what it was. And he didn't know what it would be, human or not human. And it turns out it was a human, which is greatly relieving to know that it was a human and not something far more dangerous. Now, he was also scared. Even now it is a woman, maybe it's a woman of ill repute that's come to seduce him. He was shocked. That's what it means he was startled. A, it's a human. Wow, okay, that's already startling. It's not a shindalad. Two is, okay, now that it's a human, who are you? What's going on? What are you doing to me? What right do you have to scare me like this? You would have definitely said it was completely fine to him to shout out and start screaming, going, you crazy woman, what are you doing to me? What's happening? This is another factor to take into account. In this pasuk where we say that a man was... Look at pasuk 7. In pasuk 7 it says, he ate Boaz and drunk and his heart was happy. Right? Then he came to lie at the edge of the pile. She came in stealth, revealed his feet, lay down. And vayhi, and it was, b'chatzi halayla, in the midnight, ha'ish v'yilofes, that a man became startled. Why doesn't it say Boaz became startled? You'd said in verse 7 that Boaz ate and drank and was happy. Then it should have said, and it was at midnight, that Boaz was startled. Why did he say the man became startled and turned over? Why are you... That's bizarre. Why are you saying the man? Do you hear this? It's crazy. We've mentioned him by name just now. Why are we... We'd never use the term the man. To say the man, the woman. The word ish is employed to portray greatness in dealing very kindly and patiently with Rus to let her explain her story rather than just screaming at her and throwing a pillow in her face and running away in fright. So what's going on? Why are you doing this? Also, Boaz noticed that the woman who lay at his feet did not act in any way without sneers. She had chosen to lie beside him, not the younger workers who you would have thought someone who wanted to do something that was improper would have gone to. And also she lay quietly at his feet, not near his chest, and wasn't doing anything. This was indicating that she was in no way coming for non-sneers reasons. So Boaz realized, this is obviously a sneers person, something's wrong, she needs my help. It says in verse 9, he said to her, who are you? And she replied, I'm Rus, your maidservant. Your maidservant. Amosecha. Notice the vowelization. I need you to see the Hebrew. It says, Anochi Rus. I am Rus. Amosecha, your maidservant. Look at the letter Sof. It's vowelized with a segel, a three-dot vowel. Can you see that? Three dots under the Sof. Uferasta, konfecha, spread over your garment, al amoscha, upon your maidservant. Now the Sof is vialized by a shva, two vertical dots. Can you see that? So it changed from a segel, from three dots in a triangle, an S sound, to an ah, a two-dot sound, which is not the same as it was before. This is very, very important. Extremely important, what I'm going to tell you. Now, in order to safeguard Rus's chances of success, Naomi told Rus to see where he's going to go and lie down and approach him before he falls asleep. That was Naomi's plan. Didn't go to plan, right? When he would have seen her, he would understand the significance and he would say, like mother, like daughter, you're approaching me, etc. Like the daughter of Lot was approaching her father. But it didn't turn out according to plan. And he had no idea of her movements. He didn't see Rus approaching her and therefore have time to cogitate what was happening. He woke up with a start and just saw Rus there. Now, when Boaz had no idea that Rus was next to him until he woke with a start, she was forced to answer him with a very difficult tactic. He was saying, who are you? What are you doing? Now, had I have told him my identity before he fell asleep, while his heart felt good, I would have had no need to have explained my presence and say why I'm here. It would be obvious that I'm here. And he would immediately have said, nothing need be said. He'd have chapped pshat in a second and said, I understand exactly why you're here. I'll be your redeemer. Now that he's woken up with a start, she's going to have to explain this step by step because he doesn't know what's going on. So now she's got to be very, very careful with her wording. She wasn't planning on saying anything to him. She was only planning on turning up. He would see her turning up, understand what she wants, say, I'll redeem you. She goes back to Naomi. Now she's got to speak it out. She began by saying, I am Rus. Anoichi Rus. Now those had a special message. They were saying, I'm the very same Rus of whom you've spoken so highly in the past. And you told me all the wonderful reports you've heard about me. When the overseer had a go at me and you said, I'm not listening to him and everyone should know that he's wrong. I've heard you're amazing. You're a big tzedakus. I'm that woman. And you know me to be modest and upright. So don't suspect me of being up to no good here. Now she said, I'm your maidservant. These words are key. I've got to go through this with you. This is really, really important. She wanted to say as follows. I have undergone a major change since the last time I called myself your maidservant in chapter 2, verse 13, in the heart of your maidservant. At those times, I had considered myself equal to those who richly immerse themselves, not for the sake of Judaism, but so they can work in a Jewish household and be a shifcha, a maidservant. They're forbidden to marry into the Jewish people. I am now different. I am like a genuine Jewish shifcha, like a woman born of Jewish descent who has hit hard times and has to be sold into indentured slavery to pay off her debt. Such a woman can be married. Indeed, what does the Torah say about such a shifcha? After her time of servitude is over, you shouldn't just get rid of her, you should marry her to your son. She's gone through enough difficulty in life having to become an eved, a slave, an avda, a slave to you. At least now give her the hope of being married either to you or to your son and have a better lifetime. Notice everyone's looking for the best shidduchim. Everyone wants the best shidduchim from the best family. What does the Torah say? If a decrepit woman comes to you and has to sell herself as a slave to make ends meet, don't let her just go out. Marry her afterwards. Do her the kindness of marrying her. So she's saying, I'm like a shivcha in that state. You should do me the kindness of, I am destitute. And I'm approaching you like any regular, fully fledged Jewish woman who's destitute as an indentured maidservant. And you ought to do the right thing by marrying me. Just the Torah says, you've got to marry a maidservant. You let her go. You don't just let her go. You marry her. So marry me. That's what she meant. I'm your shivcha. I'm your maidservant, mamish, like the Torah says. I mean, you've got to do a mitzvah with me. You've got to marry me. I'm not just some Gentile woman who's gone to me for just so I can work in the house. I'm a fully fledged Jewish woman that you need to marry anyway, and you've got to do yibum with me. You don't really have an option. This is a mitzvah. You don't have an option to put tefillin on in the morning. Someone comes up to you with a pair of tefillin, you haven't put them on yet, they're telling you put tefillin on. You don't have an option, I'll do it later. You don't have an option. One, I'm your maidservant, you've got to marry me. And two is, you've got to do yibum. It's a mitzvah. What is this? You've got to marry me. Nothing to discuss. That's what she says, I'm your maidservant. You've got to treat me like a fully fledged Jewish girl and not like a Gentile maidservant. And besides, only a male Moabite is forbidden to be married. But a Moabitess, as you well know, is allowed to be married. Now, it says, spread out your raiment over your maidservant. She's repeating the word maidservant. Again, the vowelization is different. We're going to get to that. She's indicating a bit of a difference in the origin. I may be seen to you like a maidservant, and you may be to me like a master. But remember that you're also my redeemer. You've got to be mindful of the mitzvah you've got to do yibum with me. It's not just, well, you're doing me a chesed in the tire of marrying me because I'm destitute. You've got to marry me. This is not up for discussion. I'm reminding you of your obligation to give yourself to me. Just like Tamar approached Yehuda to remind him of the obligation he had to marry her or give his son to her. He didn't know who she was because she was covered and thought her a prostitute. What's happening here? She's covered up to avoid looking like a prostitute. And now that she does look like a prostitute, she's saying, no, you've got to do yibum with me, being metaken for Tamar and Yehuda, while she herself is being metaken for Light and the daughters. You are a redeemer, she says. And with those words, she's explaining the reason for her nocturnal visit. I've only come here that the name of my husband can be perpetuated over his inheritance. This ain't about you. You're looking for a wife. I'm not looking for a husband. I'm looking for a redemption for my husband's soul. I've got a mitzvah to do. You must have realized that my intentions are holy, just like my ancestress, the daughter of Lot. Physically, she's my ancestor. She also went only to be with her father solely for a mitzvah. So Rus was hinting that she had chosen to lie near him rather than lie near the younger men, because she wants him to be the redeemer to bring Machlon back, because he's the greatest man in the generation. And he's a family relative to Elimelech. Makes sense. I'm only here on mitzvah purposes. If I was here on my immoral purposes, you would not be the man I choose. Do you hear what she's saying? That's what she's saying here. Do you hear what she's saying? And he gets that. Boaz gets that. Yeah, why would you be here with me unless it was a mitzvah? Now, there's two things I want to do with you. We may go a bit over time. I've got... There's another reason why she says, I'm your maidservant, repeated. Rus put herself in what might have turned out to be the most embarrassing situation. There are two good reasons why she was ready to take the risk. From the words, to whom he has espoused her, in Exodus 21:8, which is when you have a maidservant and you let her go, you've got to marry her, we're taught that one who buys a Jewish handmaid must actually marry her. Rus is saying, spread your robe over your maidservant. That's twofold. One is, it'll remind you of the law of a handmaid, that you've got to marry me, just like any master has to try to at least marry his handmaid or marry her to his son. And you've also got to spread your cloak over me as a maidservant because of Yibam. I don't see that you've really got much of an option here. She's just letting him know, it's time for a mitzvah. Okay, can you look at the Hebrew? So look at those words, amosecha, amoscha. So the vowelization is different under the sof. Under the sof, there's three dots. Under the sof, there's two dots. We're missing a dot. That one dot changes the vowel from e to a. But it's one dot that's missing. It's like three dots loses a dot, you know what I mean? And it like goes like that. You got to hear this. This is the Alshich HaKodesh. The Alshich, Rabbi Moshe Alshich, says as follows. And with this, we'll finish the Pasuk. This takes us all the way to Pasuk 9. Listen to you. Boaz says, who are you? He's saying to her, who are you? And she says, it's me, it's Rus. Rus, who had been blessed by Naomi, that she would find contentment in her husband's home, replied, I am Rus, your maidservant. Now, Amosecha is with a segel, as opposed to Amoscha with a shva. These three dots under the sof, in the first time it says that, signify three elements which made up her present self. These three dots is one, the soul of Lot's daughter. Two, Rus, her own personage. And three, the soul of Mahlon. There's Lot's daughter, Rus, and Mahlon. All in the words, Amosecha. Under that sof, there's three dots. Who am I? I'm Lot's daughter. I'm Rus. And I'm Mahlon. That's who I am. You're asking me who I am? That's actually who I am. Now, the second time she says maidservant, Amoscha, one of the dots is missing. What does she mean? She says, let's pretend I'm not Lot's reincarnated daughter. I'm not the good. Let's say I'm not her. You know, Naomi's view of me is overstated. I'm not actually the Gilgul of Lot's daughter. Even if I'm not, I've still myself and Mahlon. Anyone's not going to argue with that. No one's going to argue that Mahlon's, that's the Torah. The Torah says he died without having children. Mahlon's spirit. So there's at least two people here. There's at least me and Mahlon. If not me, Mahlon and Lot's daughter. So she isn't sure. And she's giving Boaz the answer in both ways as to who she could be. Therefore, she's saying, even if you don't feel obligated to do anything for my sake, i.e. Lot's daughter's sake, at least do so for the sake of Mahlon's spirit, because that rests with me and you are a redeemer for him. So let's say you don't like me, that's one dot. And you don't like the idea that I'm Lot's daughter, dot that dot. You can't take away the dot that I am Mahlon's vector. You have to do something here. There's a mitzvah. So forget me as Rus. Forget Lot's daughter and making a tikkun. You have to do something for Mahlon. That you have a responsibility to do. You can't take that out the mix. You can say, I don't want Rus. Physically, I don't want her. That you could say. You can say, you aren't the good dove from Moav, and therefore I have no obligation to fix up anything you're doing. Okay? Okay. But you can't say that Machlon isn't here. And because you can't say that, you've still got the din of Yibam. You've got to do it. You're a redeemer. You can't turn me away. I've got three reasons you can't turn me away. Two of them you can knock out. One of them you can't. You hear that? That's what she's saying to Boaz. I'm here on business. You have mitzvah business with me. And there's no argument. One way or another, I've locked you in. I've chosen you to be the Redeemer rather than anyone else. And indeed, you're in line. Now, we know there's someone closer. Naomi's explained that. But it's you that I want to be the Redeemer. I want to give you the schus. I remember a Rosh Kailal knocked on my door. And he said, I'm running a kollel, and I want to give you the opportunity to have the merit of funding it. You know what I mean? I'm giving you the opportunity to have the merit. That's a very nice way of asking for some money, right? But he was really genuine. He's saying, if you want the merit to be able to fund this kollel, I'm giving you the opportunity. I could have knocked on anyone's door. So too, Rus is saying, look, I've got Machlon spirit with me. Whether you like it or not, that's unarguable. I'm giving you the merit to redeem it. It's a big mitzvah. Get it done. He was like, I get you. I understand where you're coming from. This is a pure mitzvah interface. There's nothing else going on here but the mitzvah of Shifcha or Yibam and possibly the tikkun of Lot's daughter. But that one's a bit dodgy because we're not really sure. And that's where we've got to this week. Next week, Be'ez Hashem, next time, we will start with Pasuk Yud, where Boaz gives his response and explains what his part and parcel is now going to be legally to be able to look after her once he's got the next in line out of the equation, which is what we'll do next.